Hello, and welcome to another episode of Damn Art Majors.
Damn.
I am your intro host, Dutters, or Richard. Joining me, as usual, we have Adam.
Hello.
And we have Aaron.
Hi.
Excellent. Well, that went smooth. Now, on to What You Drinking, the way we start off all of our shows. I guess I'll go first, because I'm the one talking. I am drinking a Rail House Brewery oatmeal stout called Mastiff. It is from Aberdeen, North Carolina, and it is brewed by Army and Navy veterans. So, I guess in honor of Memorial Day, I went and got a veteran beer.
That's right. Yesterday was Memorial Day.
Yep.
And by yesterday, I mean technically tomorrow.
Because we record the day.
Monday is tomorrow.
Yeah.
What do you got, Aaron?
I'm drinking a beer by Ballast Point. I believe it's called Sculpin. And I know nothing else about it because I tore half the label off. But it's from California. And in my other hand is a nice warm cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Yummy.
Yeah.
Adam, what are you drinking?
I am drinking one of my last home brews. This is my second attempt at home brewing. And this is like a Bavarian Belgian wheat beer. It's light and a little tangy.
Yeah, it's got some bite to it.
Yeah, it's like only like 2.5% though, so it's pretty weak stuff. But overall, not bad.
Perfect for day drinking.
It'll get you buzzed, but that's it.
Yeah. You know you're drinking something, just not sure what.
You should try shotgunning it.
I don't think I could do that. It's pretty heavy feeling in the stomach, I don't know.
Yeah.
So we've got some news. We didn't really go into much news in the last episode.
We actually have a lot of things going on this episode, or at least a lot of things to
news.
Talk about. Yeah. First off, Aaron, where are we at with the stickers?
The sticker is done, as far as I know. I mailed you the final proof. I don't know if you've seen it and approved it or not.
I have seen it, and we got to show it to Dutters. And
I approve it. I haven't even seen it.
Excellent. The sticker's done.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with a local printer to get those printed up so we could get them in a timely fashion.
Did you decide if it was going to be like a vinyl sticker or not, or just a...
Well, originally it was going to go through a website that had very specific dimensions, but I'm going to check with the local printer that I use for my own personal stuff to see, one, if they do stickers, and two, what their specifications are to do them.
Okay.
We, you know, check in with our Facebook and the Twitter, and we will keep you posted if you're interested in stickers. And speaking of my prints, I will be attending the Fanboy Expo in Knoxville, Tennessee this weekend, pushing papers and whatnot. I don't know if we have too many Tennessee listeners, but hey, if you're in Tennessee or, you know, Asheville and feel like taking a drive, come on out to the Fanboy Expo. We even have some Firefly folks that are going to be there.
Nerd!
Leave me alone. I'm not nerd.
I have to ask, which Firefly folks are going to be there?
Kaylee and Simon.
One of my favorites.
Yes. No. Poor Simon.
Simon.
I'm not going to specify.
So, also, I have a big boo-boo that I have to address.
Band-aid.
All right, so the intro music that we have been saying, or at least let's correct this, I have been saying it's my friend Phil Wilson and his band Me, Myself, and I. Well, recently the band has come out with a EP, and I noticed on the EP the name of the band is actually Myself and I. There is no me involved. It is just Myself and I.
Are there only two members?
I think it's a four-member band. I want to say it's four.
Well, then it should be Myself and I and Me and Him.
Fair enough. it could very well just be him. Who knows? Anyway, but if you're interested and you like the intro music, check out the Myself and I Facebook page as well as earmarkstudios.com. Phil wanted me to tell you guys that people can buy a physical copy from earmarkstudios.com, and they can listen to the tracks there. They're going to release them digitally soon, but for now, you can get physical copies, which is still pretty cool.
But my computer doesn't have a CD drive. What am I going to do?
Does your car?
No.
Your car doesn't have a CD player?
Oh, no, wait, it does. That's right, because I put an aftermarket in it.
Oh, yeah. I remember I went to their Facebook page once, and they had a track posted outside of what we use for our intro and transitional music, and it was good. It was good, yeah.
Definitely.
I want to check out some more of their stuff.
I worked with Phil way back when at Hot Topic in the Greenville Mall.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, he's a good worker. I mean, just suck that.
That'll be a fun episode to get into. What we did so we could actually make art.
Yeah, right? Rolling along, one last announcement. Dutters, are you going to Charlotte anytime soon?
I am actually going to Charlotte.
Are you?
Yeah, I'll be in Charlotte. I don't know the fucking dates. I think it's the third weekend in June.
The 20th through the 22nd of June.
How did you know that I would be going to Charlotte?
Because we started a Google Calendar and I checked it.
That's right, we did. Because we're an organized system now. But yeah, well, all three of us.
All three of us will be. Yeah. Yes. And what are we going to do in Charlotte?
We're going to be going to Heroes Con.
What's Heroes Con?
It's a convention. Like we went over this earlier. You should already know what this is.
What kind?
It's
for
a
heroes?
Convention where everyone is a hero.
So it's a lot of like firefighters, police,
neckbeards, and
obesity and shame. And wait a minute. I mean, Heroes Con is a place for awesome individuals to get together and share their love and interest in comic books, and you know, women,
anime,
and
furries, and
are there gonna be chicks there?
There will probably be chicks there.
Sweet. Ladies. Ladies of the Heroes Con.
Oh, just make sure you check for IDs.
And we will be recording there, I believe, yes?
I assume so. We're going to be walking around with an awkward boom mic that we're going to be shoving into people's faces. But yes, we will be at Heroes Con the third weekend in June. So if you're in Charlotte and you have nothing better to do with your weekend, come on down to the whatever convention center.
Charlotte Convention, downtown Charlotte. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, be there. Follow the people with book bags and comic books.
Yes.
Brought to you by Heroes Hideaway?
No. Heroes aren't hard to find.
That's right.
I will be with Heroes Hideaway at Fanboy Expo. I know, there's a lot of heroes flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
At Heroes Con.
Yes.
Big damn heroes.
Big damn heroes. Yes.
That could be the title of our Heroes Con episode.
Yes! It will totally be the title of our Heroes Con episode. Yes! Anyway, so is that it for...
I believe that... Okay, now you guys can wake up, shake it off, we're done with our plugs, we're done with our news.
Wait, just kidding.
Do you got something?
No, it's okay. I'll save it for next episode.
No, go ahead, tell people. They want to hear.
Well, I recently got 4 pieces accepted into a brand new gallery in Wilmington. Thank you. Yes. I'm bowing and shooting simultaneously. But I got 4 pieces accepted into a brand new gallery that just opened last November in Wilmington called Eclipse at Blue Moon. It's a really nice gallery. It's set up in kind of a salon style. I think they represent over 200 artists or something. The space is crammed full of artwork. I mean, every conceivable corner and wall space and ceiling section is just covered. But it's a really interesting place to be accepted into because the work that I do is a little darker and set apart from the work that they normally have. So they're taking a chance on me, and it'll be entertaining to see where the interest comes from, like what type of person likes it or dislikes it.
Now, when you say dark, do you mean that you use a darker contrast in your paints?
Subject matter.
Oh. It's good to specify.
Yeah.
They're actually all pastels, but the subject matter is really fucked up.
they're all drawn in brightly colored sidewalk chalk. But it's
neon pink.
It's great to be accepted there. And I'm actually, in the next 3 weeks or so, I'm going to be installing an 11-foot tall sculpture inside as well.
Very cool.
So keep a lookout on the Facebook page of myself and Damn Art Majors, as I will be posting information and photographs shortly. Now we can go on to our next subject.
Excellent.
Anybody else? You got anything?
No.
How's your truck?
my truck is alive and reasonably well.
I saw that you got a new front bumper. It looks good.
Yeah.
The damage has been done, and we can move on.
Exactly.
We can pick up the pieces and get on with the rest of our lives.
Yep.
And the rest of the show.
We go into our first listener-suggested topic. Also, it's a roundtable discussion.
These tables are square.
They have rounded corners.
They don't know that. And that can be the difference between winning a lawsuit or losing one, as we learned between Apple and Samsung recently. So we had a listener of ours suggest an article that we should talk about.
The listeners are interacting?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes, they are. Sorry, you confused me for a second. This is an article from a website called thisiscolossal.com. And it's titled, first off, thank you to the listener that suggested that we cover this subject.
And other listeners, feel free to write in about subjects you'd like us to talk about, ranging from art to pretty much anything.
Absolutely. You can email us, you can contact us on Twitter, you can call me by phone.
We're not posting our phone numbers because I don't feel like dealing with people calling me at 2 in the morning.
Mine's posted on Facebook, or you can contact us via the Facebook page. So anyway,
direct all your calls to Aaron's cell phone
between the hours of midnight and 3 in the morning.
Yes, so I will promptly not answer it. The article is titled 271 Years Before Pantone, an artist mixed and described every color imaginable in an 800-page book. For those not familiar with what Pantone is the all-inclusive color guide. It's usually incorporated into Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop. You're probably most familiar with seeing it on a daily basis, practically in every single printed thing that you can lay your eyes upon. It is like the design standard for color reference. More or less, you can buy from them a, what is it called?
Swatch book?
Yeah, it's a swatch book, but they have a very specific name for it. I can't remember what the hell it is. But you can buy this from them, and it's like...
a couple bucks.
No, it's like $195.
Yeah. It's a couple bucks.
I'm pretty sure I looked at their website today, and it was $195. But it's nicely printed and all this stuff. Anyway, you can use it for reference. If you're out in the field and you see a color that you like at some sort of conference or convention or trade show or whatever, you can hold the swatch up to it, find the color that most directly represents it, make note of the number, and then go back and pull it up in Adobe Illustrator or Photoshop and do whatever you need to have it replicated in an actual physical paint form, or have it printed on a t-shirt, or have it printed on a coffee mug, or a cat, or a biscuit, whatever you want.
Generally, it's what graphic designers, anyone who's in the graphics industry, uses. Like generally, if you're doing like printing logos for an existing company, their logo will have the Pantone numbers associated with the correct color. So that way, they just give the numbers, and the designers can then just reference that number, pull up, and it'll be an exact match.
Yeah.
Because it's an established system of color.
Yeah.
And this is very important when it comes to things like branding for a company. Colors can also be associated with emotions and bring up memories. And I was looking through this article, and I was flipping through the digital book version of the book. And I don't know. I guess my question to you guys is, do you think back in 1692 they had a concept of branding and using the Pantones to identify things associated with those colors?
Probably not. I would imagine they were highly specialized areas that had, you know, some sort of color reference, and it was probably a place where you could buy pigments from. I don't know that they had art stores back in the day.
Right.
They probably had vendors that worked with some sort of trade, like export or import of,
you gotta think most colors back then would be coming from grinding up certain elements from nature and stuff, so you'd probably go to like an apothecary.
Yeah.
And you'd buy your dry material, whatever it is, and then you'd take that back to your studio, and then you'd combine that with turpentine or whatever.
Linseed oil.
Whatever material, water, you know, whatever, you know, the actual solution would be. and then apply that to the paper. And it's actually what I found so neat about this is that in reading the article, he notes how much the ratio of water to pigment, and he goes into extreme detail. I almost wish I read Dutch, because the whole thing is written in really fancy handwriting.
Oh yeah.
It's Dutch.
Yeah. And the artist or the person
author? It? A Bogert?
A Bogert.
Bogert?
It's Bogert. B O O G E R T.
All credibility just went out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. The guy that wrote this book was named A Bogert. And there's to my knowledge, no reference as to his role, what he did.
Yeah, it said that in the article. They have no idea who the guy is.
Yeah, but as you said, this book was strictly for watercolor. He talked about thinning down pigments with a focus in tonality using certain ratios of water.
So yeah, so where would this come into play in modern times? Like you mentioned, a swatch book. You can actually pick up a swatch book ranging in color palettes pretty cheap at a Lowe's or Home Depot. Yeah. Exactly. This is the equivalent of that, but for the 1600s, 1700s.
Even then, though, it's still, it's an 800 page book, and I feel like it's more organized.
Oh, definitely. And you get a lot more information about the colors than you would say, a swatch guide from
He's telling you how to make them
right
yourself.
Yeah. It's
not exactly the Martha Stewart collection.
Yeah, no, he's definitely looking at this more as a resource, as a reference book for someone who wants to be able to mix their own paint, not someone who wants to do a color match because they're making a shop sign for Coca-Cola.
Right.
Or the Dutch equivalent.
Yeah, it said in the article that there was a medieval book historian, and this is another great name, by the name of Eric Quackle, or Quackle. But he said that this book was intended as an educational resource, and unfortunately, though, it was the only one of its kind, it was the only copy that's known to exist, and the way in which it was preserved and stored, very few people have seen it. So the artist's intention wasn't exactly fulfill.
But luckily, because of the internet and scanners, we now have every single page online, which we'll post a link to.
Yeah, millions of people have looked at this and been like, that's neat.
Yeah. Actually, ECU, I was informed today that ECU actually has a book very similar to this in their collection, in their rare books archive. So anyone here who is an ECU student or still has their student ID can go to the ECU Joiner Library and go to the Rare Books collection and borrow a pair of their, fancy little white gloves and turn some pages on a really nice book that also has hand-painted color swatches and notations.
Yep. If you can't do that, if you're not a professor or notable historian with the qualifications to go and touch an old book, there is, as Adam mentioned earlier, a full viewable version of this, and I think it's a flash format, but it's all very high-resolution images. Mm-hmm. It's all 800 pages, and it's available via the website e-corpus.com.
.org.
Yeah.
We'll leave the link.
Shit, sorry.
So, this reminds me, now that I'm thinking about it, we all had similar books that we had to create ourselves during usually our foundation year of art school.
Mm-hmm. I still have mine.
Yeah, and design one. And little did you know, going to college for the first time, that a good portion of your first or second semester would be taken up painting 200 to 500 swatches.
Fortunately, I didn't.
Do we remember this project?
It was only specific teachers that made you.
Well, see,
that.
I had the grayscale and the color wheel.
How often do you use that book? Legitimately?
I don't, because
I did it once and it's in my brain forever.
Well, unlike you guys, I wasn't given that assignment. The closest thing I had was when I was taking a color and composition class with one of the painting professors, and he made us make a swatch template that was like a right angle graph,
right?
And all along the x-axis was the colors that you were using, the primary colors that you can get in oil paint, and then transparent glazes were on the y-axis, and the overlay of those two would give you temperatures and different tonalities that you could incorporate in your painting using glazing techniques. But I remember hearing about
oh, I about still all have mine on the bookshelf, man.
Yeah. Well, no, this actually could be useful information to anyone who's going to design to any sort of design school where they have to make swatches. And your teacher, like my teacher, requires that there is no brush strokes, that it is a perfect even tone.
Yeah.
You put it on thick and heavy, then get yourself 800 grit sandpaper, and you sand it back down, and then you do just one really light wash coat, and it cleans up your sanding marks, and you get a perfectly smooth uniform surface.
But safety first, wear a dust mask, because pigments are really poisonous.
Absolutely. But no, that totally, like, saved so much time, like, eliminating brush strokes.
Do you ever use it as a reference? Honestly,
I don't use it as a reference because by doing that process of mixing the pigments and getting everything correct and accurate, it ingrained it into my skull.
Right.
Like, when I die and they study my brain for science, and they will look at the interior of my skull, and it will literally be, like, engraved into the skull bone itself, a color wheel. And then right next to it, a grayscale will just be permanently ingrained.
Yeah. Speaking of grayscale, I do actually use one of the swatch assignments that we did in Design 1. I forgot about the 9-step grayscale that we had to make. Yep. Did you guys ever have to do that?
Yeah.
I pulled mine out the other day and used it.
I feel like mine had more than 9.
That sounds terrible, but...
You pulled out your grayscale, man?
Yeah.
Showed it to the world?
I used the
hell out of it. Just flopped it on that desk?
No, I used it when I was doing a grisaille for a portrait that I was painting.
A gris what?
A grisaille. It's a French term for... or maybe it's Italian. I think it's French because it's got two L's. You're both looking at each other like, what a fucking idiot. No, I used it because I was doing a grayscale pre-painting, like underpainting, and it worked out.
Fascinating.
So anyway, thanks to the person that sent us this article. And if you have any commentary or would like to check it out for yourself, go for it.
Definitely.
Yeah. No, I honestly, I mean, part of me really enjoys it because I really like the idea of really old books. I mean, just the whole handwritten everything. Someone taking the time and care to make something like this that would never be reproduced because at the time they didn't have the ability to print that many pigments in a book and make it feasible.
That and like clearly there's no printing press involved, so like the whole thing is written with like calligraphy and
it's all handwritten. Whenever you look at the flash portrayal of this book, there is about 50 or so pages of like it's a preface that he wrote in the beginning. It's all just writing. There's no pictures of how to use color in painting and like the intention of this book. So you can skip past that through the slide bar and look at all the nice color swatches.
Well, I think like the thing I really find impressive is how even he got everything. I don't know if he. I guess he painted directly onto the pages.
Mm-hmm. There's some age to some of them. Like the paint is stuck on the previous page and torn off a little bit, but it's really vibrant too. Like the blues in there are just electric.
Well, I kind of wonder if whoever did the scanning, if they went through and put it through a color correction process, to bring it up to
yeah, because I guess there's nothing accuracy to gain by like scanning it and like the colors are muddy and you know.
Well, it's in a museum that it's one of the bibliothèque museum, I can't remember what city, maybe London, maybe France, underpants, but I'm sure that they have a professional lighting studio and it was shot in, you know, camera raw, so the colors are true.
Yeah.
So, Aaron, you had a topic that you wanted to bring to the show for a while.
Oh yeah, the other roundtable discussion.
Yeah, I guess you call it a roundtable discussion. You get a two roundtable discussions in one episode, how about that? You're welcome.
Delicious.
Happy Memorial Day.
I can't wait to talk about this.
talk about it.
Okay, I've always wanted to talk about this on the show. By always, I mean in the last 12 episodes. It's a topic that I think about quite often. It's a topic that other people will think about and then ignore. How do you guys feel about good artists that make bad art? And what I mean by that is artists that you know, they may or may not have gone to art school. They're trying to give it a go as an artistic career as a go. They have the drive, the perseverance, the enthusiasm, and, you know, all the great qualities that would make somebody capable of being very prolific in art. But the work that they put out or sell or network falls short. Like, you just feel like it's bad. It's not of good quality. It's either not selling or it's selling very infrequently. But the person is just so good-natured and very skilled at, you know, being a social artist.
So basically, a great business person who mm-hmm. makes bad art.
Yeah. They do great business practices, but their work falls short of being paired with that.
I think they're in the wrong career.
Well, no. Let's first discuss, what do you deem bad art? Because my envision of bad art could be a totally different envision of your idea of bad art, which mm-hmm. can be totally different than, you know, a multi-million dollar dude in a suit who's in the business of buying art. So to say someone is a good artist, finger quotes, and they produce bad art, finger quotes, is really
I feel like there's a better
not
term
saying
than finger
anything
quotes.
In the sense that someone out there will view this mediocre work on a level higher than your own standard.
Yeah, that's a very good point that you're making. If I were to specify, and it's really tough to specify, because it's different per person.
Sure. I mean, are we talking craft?
One person.
Are we talking concept?
It could be a number of things, but I think what it boils down to is honesty. If you make work that is dishonest to you, you don't feel strongly about it, your heart's not in it, it shows. It absolutely shows. But that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's not going to throw money at you for it. I think bad art is work that's just uninteresting. You come to it and you see it, you try to understand it or delve into the artist's mindset, and you just come out with this feeling of ambivalence toward it. However, if you ever meet the artist and you know them personally or not, they can be a great person. They can, you know, pour their heart and soul into a piece, and it just doesn't look like the effort is there.
So basically, you're talking about an artist who is unable to transfer what they're feeling into the work they create.
Sure.
I mean, because the whole art itself is very, very subjective. So everyone's bringing different ideas and opinions to the table.
Yeah.
But I feel like with this topic in particular, it's you knowing someone personally who is attempting to make art, and they are unable to get themselves into their own artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, when I encounter a piece of artwork that someone is able to basically put themselves into, there tends to be a better communication between myself and the actual piece of artwork versus the piece of artwork that someone does where they cannot quite convey their message, their idea, their feeling into it. Then for me as the viewer, it's the same thing. I don't really get anything out of it.
Okay.
It's either way, it's a personal problem, but it's a personal problem for the person making the artwork. There's some mental block or something that they have not been able to, some hurdle they haven't been able to jump to really get their ideas through in whatever medium they're working in.
So you're talking about subject matter in that point.
Yeah.
Either subject matter or how or composition.
Subject matter, I mean, assuming that they've gone to art school, they've learned the technique. They have the techniques in their toolbox of artistic knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Their problem isn't the technique. So this person could be an incredible forger. All they're doing is copying people's artwork. They have the skill, but when they try to make their own artwork, it sucks. You look at it and you're like, dude, what is wrong with you? Like, you're a great guy. You have great ideas. I think you're going to go places, just like that granola commercial. But unfortunately, I don't get it. Like, yeah. I see this, and I understand you're trying. And honestly, I just feel pity. Like, I look at the piece. For me, encountering someone like this, I just have pity. Because it's like, you're just not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I see your ability. You have craftsmanship. And you have skill. But you are conveying nothing to me that I care about.
Would you... Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to take the opposite end of this idea. Because I don't necessarily believe if your piece lacks concept, it's deemed a bad piece of art. Especially in the design world where concept is usually kind of pushed to the side a little bit more so.
No, it's not even... It's not concept.
I think when... The flip side of that, when that forger lacks the technique, lacks the skill, and lacks the patience to achieve craftsmanship, that's when you get a bad piece of art.
Okay, so you're talking about craft.
Yeah, okay. I believe to deem something a bad piece of art, it's falling apart at the seams, like the glue is coming undone,
mm-hmm.
you know? That, to me, shows, one, you didn't take the time to learn what you were doing. Two, you didn't care enough about your work to do it. And three, you have the audacity to put it up on the wall against a bunch of other people who actually care about their shit and demand the same respect.
So you're... Okay, let me say
regardless
this.
Of concept.
Well, this subject is very specific to the vocabulary that you're using. So, Adam, you're talking about craft.
Sure.
Would you group in talent and skill with
sure.
that same... Okay. Richard, you're talking about subject matter, composition, and content.
Yeah.
These are all very great points. They fit in, you know, perfectly with the question that I'm asking.
I feel like we're kind of... Adam and I, we aren't even arguing with each other. I feel like we're arguing...
Two different ideas of
the same topic.
Sure.
And I should specify that when I say good artists that make bad art, I'm using good and bad as just generalizing terms. So I am talking about subject matter as well as content. Composition, as well as what Adam was talking about.
Because, I mean, I agree with that. There's definitely artists out there who suck. I mean, like all they have...
That should be the name of this episode. Artists who suck.
I mean,
part
all
one.
They have going for them is financial backing and connections.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people who are just born into the right world at the right time.
Yeah, they have the silver spoon scenario.
They have the ability to cut a fucking... sheep in half, thrown in some formaldehyde, and they get fucking money out of it.
Shh, don't pick from the top tier.
But, at the same time, there are countless artists who have an incredible background in art, an incredible skill and talent, but when they try to make pieces of artwork, they don't connect to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me, that's the good artist. It is a good person. I mean, they may not actually be a good person. They can go around, you know, doing terrible things, but they generally are a good artist. They have talent. They can sit down and do portraits all day long. But when they actually try to make a personal piece of artwork to hopefully hang on a gallery wall and sell that is a part of themselves, people look at it and they just go, eh. But there's just no... They look at it and they're like, yeah, the person's talented, you know, whatever, that's great. But I get nothing out of this. And for them, 99% of the people out there are going to look at their artwork and just go, eh. And they're just going to fade into nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to connect with that 1% of people who will look at it and be like, oh, my grandson made a painting and it's beautiful, so I'll pay him for it.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, I mean, they have the skill. You look at it and you're like, this person has talent. But whatever it is, whatever's going on in their life, they cannot convey an emotion through their talent.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot convey anything that is connecting with me as a viewer.
So would you, in this instance, would you take the time to, if they're a friend of yours, or even if you happen across their show and they strike up a conversation with you, what would you say to them?
I think the best idea is to challenge them. Not dissuade them, because I don't believe...
No, absolutely
I don't
not.
Believe just because you're not... Just because someone's not producing good art,
mm-hmm.
to your standards, doesn't mean you have the right to dissuade them for doing something that makes them happy. But challenge them and coach them and, you know, help them become, you know, universally better at their craft, at their concept, at their psychology. Talk to them and you know, get inside their head a little bit.
I mean, I personally would try to figure out what language they're using. mm-hmm. like talk to them and be like, okay, what are you trying to tell me in this? Like, what are you hoping that people will get out of this piece?
Well, then you open the floor for them to go on a long-winded rant.
Good. Maybe in that rant, they'll discover something about themselves
right.
that will they might have their own epiphany.
Or even during the rant, you can help them filter their thoughts down to a cohesive, you know, spark note of their thought, and then translate that into a visual concept.
Yeah.
I mean, it pretty much is, basically, it's going to end up, no matter what, if you encounter a person like this and you really care about them and you want to take the time to make their art better, basically being a teacher, pretty much you're sitting down and you're opening the floor for a critique.
Mm-hmm.
An open discussion critique of their artwork, and which is a very dangerous thing because you could come. I mean, you could try to do this with somebody, and they could close themselves off because they keep their work so it's so personal to them that you could absolutely destroy any relationship you have with this person.
Yeah,
if you insult
it's
them,
it's really easy to piss artists off when you're talking about their work.
I mean, it's very easy to piss people off when it comes to their artwork.
Especially if they put their own pride in it and they put their own backstory. I mean, if they do have an emotional attachment to the image or the concept of the art piece, you know, you're essentially shitting on part of them.
Well,
nobody takes that well.
For me...
But with that being said, to a degree, you need to take criticism and you need to distance yourself from your art a bit, especially if you're, like, in it to sell it.
But
just sit there and be
being an artist, you absolutely have to take criticism.
This is my horticrux. I need it to live.
If you're an artist and you didn't take criticism,
you'd be a bad artist.
You would be a bad artist and you would have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Like, there would be no instance to learn. Like, it's one of the core, I can't say core principles. I think that's an actual, like, phrase used for something else. You know what? Fuck it. I will say it's a core principle, but it's not a principle of design. Taking criticism in art, ever since art was sold as a product, has been necessary.
Absolutely.
Sure. Period. Done.
Yeah. No, and I mean, it definitely, I think something that is so great about art school is it prepares you for that, because you're in a cloistered environment where you're struggling with your peers to create this a piece in time for a critique or something. You're all bringing it out, you're all presenting this, and then you have the one voice of reason, the professor, who's kind of leveling the playing field as far as how the critique goes. But it mentally prepares you for when you by yourself are presenting your work in a gallery and there's no one there to buffer the comments.
Yeah,
there's no one there.
Professor there.
No, so what's happening, people are coming up to you and they could be just like, dude, I don't know why you're here. Like, this is shit. But then, of course, you're going to get the grandmothers and the friends who are going to come up, and they're just going to sit there and go, dude, this is amazing, man. You're awesome. You're a fantastic artist. And
I like your aesthetics.
And it's like, the same time, you know that they know little to nothing about what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
So that's why, for me, I would value that one or two or three people that come up and go, I really like what you're able to do, but I'm not sure I get it.
Well, here's the thing. Like, I feel like you shouldn't shit on somebody's art if you don't like it. You should first try to understand what their thought process was, and then, like I said, just help them convey it better.
Mm-hmm.
By doing so, by the way, do not try to instill yourself into that piece of art. Well, I would have done it this way, and I would do it this way, and this, that, and the other.
Well, no, that's not a critique anymore.
It's not a critique. It's a criticism. Well, it's you trying to instill your views into somebody else's project, and that's not right. But to help someone bring themselves out more in their own art, I think is the goal.
I like how this has turned into how to talk to artists in galleries by damn art majors.
Well, I mean, it's you know, that's definitely part of the situation. I mean, it's part of this discussion.
Yeah. But I also feel like this can go beyond, you know, like, I have concerns that some of our listeners are not, in fact, artists and may not even give two shits about art.
Well, they can just fast forward through this part.
No, but there is no follow-up part in which they fast forward to, unfortunately. So, I guess to rope in the general audience a little bit, like, you can apply what we're talking about to everyday situations. If you are a manager of people in, be it retail, an office setting, anything, even if you're just working with other people, if their work is not to the standard that it needs to be, how
can fire them and hire someone better? You're paying them money.
I'm a big advocate for, like, not necessarily firing people as your first go-to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big advocate for coaching and teaching and helping people give their all. If they're not willing to budge, then yeah, get rid of them. They're done. Or, i.e., rip their painting off the gallery wall and take the piss on it. I don't care. But coach them and make them better. That's, I think, ultimately, outside of art, what this conversation's about.
Mm-hmm. I would say at every given instance, anytime you're discussing someone's artwork with them, if they fit this scenario of being a very enthusiastic, driven artist, they're having a go at making a career, but their work is, you know, a little subpar or lacking in, you know, content. Honesty is always the best policy. Like, I hate that phrase, but off the top of my head, I can't come up with a better one. Absolute honesty in art is what makes art so fucking great. I mean, you can give substantial feedback and be nice about it at the same time. It's all a matter of prefacing what you say with, like, if you need to include a disclaimer, like, hey man, I'm going to be as honest with you as possible, because you're a friend of mine, or I really appreciate where you're coming from with your artwork, but this is how I view it, and you know, please don't get mad because of this reason, this reason, this reason.
And remember, it is all an opinion.
Yeah, it is an opinion, and if they don't accept it, they don't accept it. I mean, they will go home and get mad about it, but if they are a good artist, they will use it to their advantage at some point in time.
Absolutely.
However, good artists that make bad art, they occur at the bottom end of the totem pole, the middle end of the totem pole, and at the top tier of the totem pole. Like, there's artists that make millions and millions of dollars that their work is just fucking garbage, but they're a good artist by definition.
Or a good salesman.
Yeah, or a good salesman and a good businessman. When you get up to that top tier, it's basically all business sometimes.
Sure.
When you start throwing multiple dollar amounts, or no, multiple dollar, multiple zeros at a work of art, there is some factor of business that comes into play. Especially if you're anywhere close to New York. I think one of the downfalls of art school is what it indoctrinates in students. This, like, theme that you end up learning and feeling in the bottom of your gut, that to be a great artist, you have to be unique. You have to be capable of, you know, stylistically providing a product that no one else can, with the ability to argue its purpose day in and day out, its purpose and importance. This certainly could be the making of a good artist or a great artist, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, because in that that sequence, where is the honesty? Where is the personality? Where is the you in that theme? I mean, it's a prescribed structure, and a lot of times that's the failing of a good artist, is they can't get that out of their mind, and the honesty is very easily lost. So I think if you're able to relate that to a friend of yours, or even a stranger that is obviously making very impassioned work, but it sucks, definitely keep that in mind.
Yep.
Thanks for the rousing follow-up.
Well, you were kind of on a thing there.
And, yeah, sorry.
Wow.
That was a really good graduation speech.
It really
I would never say that at a graduation.
Yeah, it really, something like that really, really takes me back to, school. But you know what they say about going back?
Time travel's a bitch.
The next one will be better.